Hello and welcome to this discussion on myeloproliferative neoplasms, integrating new therapies into challenging case scenarios. I'm Prithvi Bose, an associate professor in the Department of Leukemia and the Division of Cancer Medicine at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. And I'm joined tonight by Dr. Ruben Mesa, Director of the Mays Cancer Center at the UT Health San Antonio MD Anderson and the Mays Family Foundation Distinguished University Presidential Chair in San Antonio, Texas, and Dr. Rajit Rampal, Assistant Member and Clinical Director of the Leukemia Service at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. These are our disclosures. These are the disclosures of the Planning Committee. We will get started in just a moment here with two overviews, a global bird's eye overviews of the field from Dr. Rampal and Dr. Mesa, and then we'll get into some cases and share our thoughts on management of those cases. The management of MPNs, as you are aware, is a clinical challenge, particularly for those patients who fail standard first-line therapy. And we have some newer therapies now, we have treatment guidelines, but it can be a little overwhelming and a little bit difficult for the community hematologists to integrate all these rapidly changing paradigms into practice recommendations. We will briefly review the current treatment guidelines for polycythemia vera and myelofibrosis, and then get into some cases as I was just alluding to. We'll start with a review of the biologic and clinical features of the MPNs and the principles that guide treatment selection. With that, I will turn it over to Dr. Rampal for his talk on risk stratification and treatment considerations in PV and MF.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bose. So the myeloproliferative neoplasms are clonal hematopoietic stem cell disorders that include polycythemia vera, essential thrombocythemia, and myelofibrosis. Importantly, although the phenotypes of the diseases can differ, it's important to recognize that the genomic hallmark of the disease is consistent across the phenotypes, and that is activation of the JAK-STAT pathway. What we have known for some time is that activating mutations in a non-receptor tyrosine kinase, JAK2, account for the majority of mutations that we see in patients with MPN. But other mutations within this pathway, including calreticulin mutations and MPL mutations, certainly account for most of the remaining patients who have an MPN phenotype. It's important to know that there are still about 10 to 15% of patients where we have not identified a driver mutation. There are very rare mutations as well, such as LINK, that are also known to cause JAK-STAT activation. Now, within the MPNs, in most patients with ET and PV, there is typically only one mutation, a JAK-STAT driver mutation, but certainly other mutations can occur less frequently. The situation in myelofibrosis is somewhat different, where a large proportion of patients can have more than one mutation. As we will talk about a little bit later in this talk, that does have prognostic implications. Let's start by talking about polycythemia vera. So we know that the natural history of polycythemia is such that the median survival is about 20 years from diagnosis, and that does appear to be inferior to that of normal controls. The major thing that we worry about with polycythemia, as you can see from the slide, is thrombosis. The 15-year thrombosis risk is about 27%. And by and far, that is what our interventions are aimed at trying to prevent. Symptom burden is also an important consideration in these patients, as has been well documented by Dr. Mesa and his group. Those are really the two major things we think about in polycythemia at the time of diagnosis. But it's also important to recognize that transformation to myelofibrosis and acute leukemia are significant risks for our patients, particularly as they have their disease ongoing for a number of years. So the goals of therapy really, again, are to reduce symptom burden and to decrease the risk of thrombotic events. How do we do that? Well, the therapeutic modalities at hand include cytoreductive therapies like hydroxyurea and interferons, as well as JAK inhibitors, principally ruxolitinib. It's also important to recognize antithrombotic modalities like aspirin, as well as lifestyle modifications, talking to patients about diet, keeping their cholesterol, and keeping their blood sugars in check. So with the idea that thromboembolic events are our major focus in patients with PV, there is risk stratification for the management of PV patients. And we deem patients to be low risk if they are under the age of 60 or if they've never had a thrombotic event, as well as if they don't have any overt cardiovascular risk factors. And we deem them to be high risk if they are over the age of 60 or if they've ever had a thromboembolic event. It's important to also think about this in relative terms. These are relative risks, and we know that patients with MPN do have a higher risk of thrombotic events relative to the general population. So low risk doesn't mean no risk. How do we approach patients based on this risk stratification? Well, principally in patients who fall into the low risk category, the mainstays of therapy are to phlebotomize with a goal of hematocrit less than 45% and to treat with aspirin. If a patient becomes symptomatic and the symptoms are not controlled by phlebotomy or the use of aspirin, those patients can certainly be considered for cytoreductive therapy. But again, this is our general principle to low-risk PV patients. What about high risk? Well, for patients with high-risk PV, the standard of care is cytoreductive therapy as well as aspirin and phlebotomy as needed intermittently. The agents that are used in practice are Hydrea and pegylated interferon. The question that has been discussed for many years in the field now is which one is better, is one better, and how do we approach frontline therapy? Several trials have sought to examine this question, and I will briefly review two such trials with you. One was the Myeloproliferative Research Consortium 112 study, and this was a randomized study of patients with PV and ET who required cytoreductive therapy. Patients were randomized to hydroxyurea or to interferon, pegylated interferon. At 24 months after randomization, data demonstrates that the overall response rate, a composite of complete response and partial response, was statistically the same in both treatment groups, indicating that there really was no advantage to either treatment modality in patients who were being treated up front. Now, in contrast to that is ROPEG interferon, which is a new formulation of interferon that is given every 2 weeks as opposed to traditional interferon dosing, which is once a week. And in this trial, patients were selected if they had polycythemia vera and were either naive to treatment or had been treated with hydroxyurea for less than 3 years. In this study, patients were randomized to ROPEG interferon or hydroxyurea. Interestingly, if we look at the data with hydroxyurea in green and ROPEG interferon in red, if we look at the proportion of patients who had a hematologic response, this is not a bone marrow response, but this is a hematologic response. At 12 months, there was no difference between either treatment arms, which is very much consistent with the MPN-RC-112 study. However, with further duration of therapy and looking at it at 36 months, we see that the curves actually do flip, and there becomes a statistical advantage for ROPEG interferon. So based on these data, this drug was actually approved by the European Union last year. It remains to be seen when and if the drug will be approved in the United States, and so it's not currently a standard treatment that we can offer in the United States. So what about patients who fail therapy, people who are high risk but have been treated and don't respond to therapy or have toxicity that's unacceptable from their therapy? If they start with interferon, they can be switched to hydroxyurea. If they started on hydroxyurea, they could be switched to interferon. But more recently, in the last several years, JAK inhibitors, principally ruxolitinib, has been studied in this space. In a randomized phase 3 trial, when ruxolitinib was compared to best available therapy in patients who were resistant or intolerant to hydroxyurea, there was a superiority in terms of spleen size reduction and hematocrit control observed with ruxolitinib. So based on these findings, ruxolitinib has been approved as a second-line agent to treat polycythemia vera patients who are resistant or intolerant to hydroxyurea. Finally, with regard to the risk of progression to myelofibrosis or acute leukemia, recent work has started to integrate molecular profiling to try to determine who are the patients who are most at risk of disease progression. A recently published paper from the Mayo Clinic group has identified SRSF2 mutations, SRSF2 is a splicing factor, as a key factor that seems to be associated with an increased risk of disease progression. These findings need to be validated, of course, in a larger cohort. Let's switch gears now to myelofibrosis, which I think is a little bit more of a complicated topic because the stratification is not so simple. That is, I think, in part because the disease manifestations are multiple. Patients can have progressive symptoms, constitutional symptoms, namely. Patients can have progressive organomegaly, and they can have progressive cytopenias, and ultimately they can transform to acute leukemia. So how we approach the patient is really much individualized based on what their symptom or issue is. At the outset of diagnosis, we can use the International Prognostic Scoring System, which incorporates a number of clinical factors, including the age, the presence of constitutional symptoms, anemia, leukocytosis, and peripheral blasts, to stratify patients in terms of their expected survival. Throughout the duration of their disease, though, we use the dynamic International Prognostic Scoring System, which largely uses the same criteria. There's also the dynamic International Prognostic Scoring System Plus, which takes into account transfusion requirements and platelet counts as well as karyotype. Now, as I talked about at the beginning of the talk, we know that mutations do play a role in myelofibrosis in terms of the risk of progression. And there are principally four mutations that we know of that are associated with an increased risk of disease progression and transformation to acute leukemia. These are ASXL1, EZH2, IDH1 and 2, and SRSF2. There are other mutations that are emerging, like RAS pathway mutations, that seem to also have similar implications. But these four mutations were used in development of a risk scoring system called the MIPS-70, which incorporates clinical factors, as you can see here, but also the presence of high molecular risk mutations, HMR, as demonstrated here. And the presence of those mutations, or more than one of those mutations, has prognostic implications for patients. If we look at the incorporation of all of these variables, we see that in this scoring system, there's a clear stratification between patients with low-risk disease and those with intermediate or high-risk or very high-risk disease. Now, it's important to recognize that this does not tell us how to treat the patient. Rather, it tells us what is the likelihood of the disease progressing. And the major implication may be for timing of allogeneic stem cell transplant. It may be reasonable to defer a referral for an allogeneic stem cell transplant for a low-risk patient. However, a patient with high-risk or very high-risk disease likely warrants referral to a transplant specialist. But in terms of how we actually treat MF, as I stated earlier, it really depends on what the major manifestation is. There are a variety of different treatments available for patients with anemia. For patients with enlarged spleens, ruxolitinib and fedratinib are FDA approved, and these are clear indications for their use, as well as for constitutional symptoms. For things like acceleration of disease, hypomethylating agents have been used, but ultimately, in order to improve survival, stem cell transplant remains our best modality. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Mesa.
Well, great. Well, wonderful discussion, Rajit. And I'm going to hopefully add to some of the issues that you've raised to try to frame where are some of our clinical challenges as a transition to we get to some of the cases to really help to discuss some of the challenges and how we overcome them. So first, really, what is our current state? Well, as Rajit was mentioning, I like to think of each of the diseases in a bit of an algorithm. So I approached the patient with ET in 2020, both my treatment as well as our current guidelines, an accurate diagnosis. I like to think about survival, and many of our risk scores really focus on that, but also the disease burden, developing our treatment plan, our frontline medical management, which with ET is now likely hydroxyurea in terms of cytoreduction, aspirin, perhaps interferon. These individuals may progress to myelofibrosis. We may consider second line or clinical trials. or rarely progression to acute leukemia, although usually they would first go through myelofibrosis. Now with polycythemia vera, a very similar pathway, although we clearly include in that frontline piece control of hematocrit, whether that be through phlebotomy, and then the use of cytoreductive therapies. Here I think it is more clear that interferon is at least as good as hydroxyurea, if not better, and much discussion regarding that piece. These patients can progress. Our second line therapy, including ruxolitinib and JAK inhibition, and again, the comment on acute leukemia. Now, indeed, as we look to see what that looks like in terms of our treatment algorithms by our NCCN guidelines, it really calls into the need for the clinician to first stratify risk, manage cardiovascular risk factors, utilize aspirin, control phlebotomy, a very holistic approach, monitoring for the adequacy of that control. And here is the unmet gap in many individuals, the identification that that is inadequate, whether that be through new events, persistent need for phlebotomies, splenomegaly, symptomatic thrombocytosis, progressive features, and then initiate your cytoreductive therapy, or clearly if they've progressed, to follow that algorithm. Now for patients with myelofibrosis, the treatment algorithm is a bit more complex. We need that accurate diagnosis, and an unmet gap is frequently not recognition early enough of progression from ET or PV to MF. Survival assessment, those risk scores that Rajit nicely covered, but then really an assessment of disease burden, developing your treatment plan, and then deciding do they progress to stem cell transplant, is that sooner or later? Our frontline medical management, which now includes ruxolitinib and potentially fedratinib, and then if they went to medical therapy, which occurs in the majority, if they progress, should we circle back to that transplant? Do we move on to alternative second-line therapy? Or if they've progressed, do we move along the path of therapy for acute leukemia? Now, this algorithm is heavily driven by the important contribution that ruxolitinib played to the therapy of myelofibrosis. With its approval now almost 10 years ago, based on the COMFORT trials, which clearly demonstrated improvement in splenomegaly and symptoms compared to placebo and best alternative therapy. Indeed, as we look at our NCCN treatment guidelines for myelofibrosis, they similarly build off of this pathway. Now patients have largely been stratified into lower or higher risk based on those survival algorithms, with symptomatic lower risk patients being considered for medical therapy with ruxolitinib, a clinical trial, or perhaps observation. Now the important piece here is to be monitoring for the quality of that response, and if so, to either continue or seek an alternative approach. Now, there remain several current key challenges and gaps. For ET, I would say that there still is a question, what is that optimal frontline therapy? Is that hydroxyurea? Is that interferon? How do we prevent disease progression? An important goal that we largely don't discuss because we lack good surrogate markers. And what is the role of JAK inhibition in ET? Is it second line? Is it third line? It is still not fully defined. In PVERA, this remains a key question. Should all patients start on interferon or hydrea, or should we be considering JAK inhibition earlier in this algorithm? And similarly, how do we prevent disease progression? We know that with polycythemia vera, we similarly have the challenge of hydroxyurea failure. And I would say that there are many patients in the United States, in my estimation, who have failed hydrea yet remain on the drug. They're on suboptimal doses, they have inadequate control of the disease, they don't feel well, or they have overt toxicity, and there frequently has been a delay in changing them to a second-line therapy with ruxolitinib or even considering moving them to pegylated interferon. Now, in myelofibrosis, without question, one of the greatest gaps is what to do after ruxolitinib. Now, up to this point in time, prior to the approval of fedratinib, we had really no options outside of a clinical trial for initiating second-line therapy. Indeed, what even defined ruxolitinib failure is difficult to state because it is a continuous variable. Is it based on suboptimal spleen response? If so, what number? What about bleeding or complications or cytopenias? Have they had an adequate dose? Indeed, defining failure is a complex topic. Now, how might our new therapies change our treatment guidelines? So I've superimposed upon the higher risk where our new therapies may come into play. You'll see in green that fedratinib now is an option in our higher risk patients that have an adequate platelet count and that it has an approval in frontline in parallel with fedratinib. Now, if we go across this slide, one, we know of therapies in development, such as luspatercept, which is approved now in MDS and hemoglobinopathies, may play a role in aiding MF-associated anemia, or the JAK inhibitor momelotinib. We know that the BET inhibitor CPI-610 might play a role in either the frontline in combination or in second line. Other second line therapies, including the LSD1 inhibitor, RUX combinations, or other JAK inhibitors may play a role. Pacritinib, the JAK inhibitor that is safe in individuals with thrombocytopenia, might have a frontline indication for that group. And what about new data upcoming? Indeed, there are many important studies ongoing, including registration studies to further build on the evidence for pacritinib and momelotinib, and we hope to see those data in the near future that may well lead to approvals. We also know that there is a very robust pipeline targeting everything from cell cycle checkpoint, anti-fibrosing agents, signaling tyrosine kinase inhibitors, the JAK inhibitors I mentioned, MDM2 inhibitors, immunomodulatory, and several epigenetic modifiers. Indeed, it is a robust pipeline of many agents that have now given us a robust clinical trial portfolio to explore. So many unmet gaps, many things in the pipeline. Perhaps I'll hand it over back to my colleague, Dr. Bose, to walk us through some cases to apply some of these principles that I've raised and that Rajit have raised.
Thank you, Ruben. Thank you, Rajit. That was those were two really phenomenal presentations of covering a lot of material. And now, as Ruben just alluded to, we will try to get into some of the more nitty-gritties of actually applying some of these concepts in managing patients. So we have three cases for you tonight. I'll walk you through the first one, and we'll be discussing each of these as we go along. So this is a 55-year-old patient with polycythemia vera that is resistant to hydroxyurea. And you heard a little bit about the concept of resistance to hydroxyurea and the definitions, etc. So the case is a 55-year-old gentleman who is a smoker, who is evaluated for frequent headaches and dizziness. The hemoglobin is very high, as you see here, 20.5, hematocrit 63. White count and platelets are actually normal. They are often elevated in PV, but in this case, they are normal. The MCV is 72. The JAK2 V617F mutation is detected. Again, this is found in about 95% of patients with PV. It has a fairly high variant allele fraction. You do normally see a higher VAF in PV than in ET. And the bone marrow is consistent with PV. The patient begins phlebotomy and aspirin. Note he is younger than 60, so as Rajit described, this is a lower risk patient by age. They are not telling us if they've had a clot. So phlebotomy and aspirin is their standard management. But in the next 3 months, he requires 3 phlebotomies and has continuing headaches, dizziness, and nausea. And hydroxyurea is added. As Ruben showed you, the NCCN guidelines allow for certain situations in which you can add cytoreductive therapy in a low-risk patient. So this would be one example with the continuing symptoms and phlebotomy requirement. But he needs 5 more phlebotomies over the next 3 months. And at this point, the hydroxyurea dose is increased to 3 pills a day, so 1.5 grams a day. The saga sort of continues, and 3 months later, he is still phlebotomy dependent and he is complaining of pruritus. And at this point, the hydroxyurea dose is increased to a quote unquote maximum of 2 grams per day. And we'll come back to that. However, this is not sufficient either, and 2 more phlebotomies are needed over the next 3 months. And now he's complaining of abdominal fullness. You feel a spleen 6 centimeter below the left costal margin, and perhaps because of the hydrea, the high dose that he's on, he's complaining of some taste issues. So, before we go further into some of the data around this issue, let me ask both Rajit and Ruben how they would approach this patient, what their views are with this information that I've just shown you.
Well, perhaps I can jump in. You know, so one, I think it's a very typical case, so it is a good one for us to discuss. You know, I do find, in particular, although, you know, the quote risk of vascular events is, still quote low because they are under the age of 60 and they've not had a vascular event. You know, I would say this individual probably has much more risk than that might suggest. He's a smoker, he's almost 60 years of age, probably has other comorbidities that are adding to it. Additionally, he presents with a very high hematocrit and hemoglobin, which suggests to me that he likely will be inadequately controlled by phlebotomies alone. I think it is appropriately recognized that there's inadequate symptom control with the phlebotomies alone, which I think is more common than we recognize. And then they've given it a solid try with the hydroxyurea, but it is not uncommon, you know, just as not tolerating hydroxyurea well and has more aggressive disease features. You know, so I think, again, this is an individual, particularly in the setting of splenomegaly, I would think would be very appropriate for consideration of ruxolitinib as second-line therapy. Rajit, what do you think?
Yeah, Ruben, I think you can make a very important point to our audience, which is that guidelines are guidelines, right? And there's nothing magic about the age of 60 as a demarcating line between a high-risk and a low-risk patient. And clearly there are things in this patient's history, the smoking history, for example, that are concerning for a thromboembolic event. That makes us concerned. The patient has fairly proliferative disease, which is also a concern, and that's not something that's taken into account, of course, in our stratifications, as we were talking about earlier. I think the final thing, you know, of course, is that the disease is not being adequately controlled with current measures, and one is now approaching the point where the drugs being used to control the disease, the hydroxyurea, are becoming intolerable. So I think certainly this is a patient who very much would fit to the criteria for switch to ruxolitinib.
What do both of you make of the phlebotomy requirement here? It seems really very frequent, right? It's more than once a month. You guys think that plays into your decision making as well?
It does. You know, I think frequent phlebotomies, once patients have had the first round of phlebotomies and become iron deficient, you know, individuals that still are requiring a lot of phlebotomies, one, there's a lot of time, hassle, and expense, but two, frequently are inadequately controlled. You know, so the fact that that still is required, you know, suggests to me the need to really move to an alternative approach. I do find that some of these individuals end up needing combination therapy as well, if inadequately controlled with one agent.
Thank you, Ruben. So moving on here, we've talked about this a little bit earlier. Ruben showed you some of this. So these are the formal criteria for hydroxyurea resistance or intolerance. And as Rajit nicely pointed out, guidelines are guidelines. I mean, you don't always adhere to them. But this is a nice framework. So basically, I won't read through all of this, but the idea is that if you have given them a reasonable dose and duration of hydroxyurea, and you are still really not controlling the myeloproliferation, that really is resistance. And the specific criteria are listed. The other aspect of this is intolerance. So if at the lowest dose that you need to maintain remission, you are having cytopenias in the white cells, in the platelets, or non-heme toxicity as listed on the slide, those would be your criteria for intolerance. So this is just a useful framework to remember. And also important to point out that it's not necessarily 2 grams a day for 3 months, because many people cannot tolerate that. Some studies have shown only 6% have gotten up to that dose. But it's really the maximum tolerated dose for the patient. And the non-heme toxicity, frankly, at any dose. The dose is not important there. So this is something I like to point out, which is that it's actually maybe more than side effects or not controlling the counts enough or the spleen enough or needing too many phlebotomies. It's probably more serious than that. So this slide shows you that resistant to hydroxyurea, now this is not intolerance, this is resistance, is actually bad from a survival standpoint and a leukemic transformation standpoint. In fact, not shown here, there is some similar data even with intolerance, but only the specific type of intolerance in which the patients get leukopenic. Again, that's not shown here, but this is just reminding you that hydroxyurea resistance is bad from a survival standpoint. And then this is what I was alluding to when I asked the question about the phlebotomies. This is something I go by in my own practice. This is data from the Spanish group showing that if you are on hydroxyurea and you're still needing 3 or more phlebotomies a year, you have a higher rate of thrombosis. So that is something I find practically, clinically useful for my decision making when I'm trying to think whether I need to switch a patient. And then this is work from Ruben's group when he was at the Mayo Clinic a number of years ago, showing that the symptom burden of patients on hydroxyurea is quite significant. As you see here, the patients on hydroxyurea were more symptomatic across all these different symptoms than those that were not on hydroxyurea, suggesting that hydroxyurea use is just a marker of more symptomatic disease. Obviously, you're going to use hydroxyurea primarily in high-risk patients, and this is probably a surrogate of the fact that they just have not just more proliferative disease in terms of counts and things like that, but also worse symptoms. Here shows the response trial. So just to orient you to this slide, the response trials, again, are the trials that got ruxolitinib approved back in 2014 for hydroxyurea-resistant or intolerant PV. So on the left, actually, is the response 2 data, and on the right are the response data. The response trial preceded the response 2 trial. The latter was mainly conducted in Europe. The response trial and the response 2 trial were very similarly designed. Hydroxyurea resistant or intolerant patients got either ruxolitinib or best available therapy. And as Ruben alluded to earlier, the best available therapy actually ended up being hydroxyurea in quite a few of these patients, because frankly there is not anything very much better for those patients in that group. So you see the numbers here strikingly similar between between the two trials, except, of course, the spleen, because that was a fundamental difference in the design or the eligibility, with the response trial being conducted in patients with splenomegaly and the response 2 trial being conducted explicitly in patients without splenomegaly. So with that exception, the other data, as you see here with hematocrit control, symptom control, complete hematologic response rates are very, very similar and clearly superior for ruxolitinib compared to the BAT arm. And what's the longevity, what's the durability of those responses? Pretty good. So this is the 5-year follow-up of response published this year, 2020, and it shows you that the duration of hematocrit control and, or rather I should say, the probability of hematocrit control, the probability of maintaining a spleen volume reduction greater than 35% were quite high in the 70% range, and this is 5 years of follow-up. Now, as we've been saying earlier, thrombosis prevention is the main goal of what we do in PV. So this shows you here that the ruxolitinib patients, the patients randomized to ruxolitinib, had a numerically lower rate of thrombotic events. However, this was not statistically significant, but clearly numerically lower. And even if you look at the crossover patients, because as you can imagine, almost everybody crossed over, those patients too have a much lower incidence of thrombotic events than the BAT patients. Symptoms. So this breaks it down in a little bit more granular detail. We saw earlier that in the ruxolitinib arm, about 45 to 49% of patients had that 50% improvement in the total symptom score that we always measure in MPN trials. But here, this breaks it down for you a little bit more into these various clusters. Again, work pioneered by Rubin and his group. Cytokine symptom cluster, referring to tiredness, itching, night sweats, daytime sweats, muscle aches, hyperviscosity symptoms, as well as the spleen-related symptoms, all of which benefited with ruxolitinib. And with that, we will move into MF, ruxolitinib refractory MF to be specific, and Rajit will walk us through this.
Thank you. So we're going to talk about a 62-year-old who has MF and develops ruxolitinib refractory disease. So Ms. T is a 62-year-old female with primary myelofibrosis. Due to splenomegaly and constitutional symptoms, the patient was started on ruxolitinib at a dose of 15 milligrams twice daily 2 years ago, with improvement in both symptoms and spleen size. The baseline bone marrow was notable for 2 out of 3 reticulin fibrosis. Mutations at the time of diagnosis were JAK2, ASXL1, and TET2. Patient had deletion 20q on cytogenetic studies. Now, after being on therapy, the patient has begun to experience progressive splenomegaly over the last 3 months, when initially she had an improvement in her symptoms. Currently, white count is 25,000, hemoglobin 9, platelets are 250,000. So what are her treatment options? So I guess maybe we could talk about that a little bit more. In terms of how you would approach this patient, I guess maybe the first question to throw out to both of you is, given the patient's profile at the beginning, the cytogenetics and the bone marrow fibrosis, as well as the genetics, would you have concerns at the very front in terms of when you started treating this patient that there may be risk of failure?
Well, they certainly have the ASXL1 mutation, which we know is an adverse one and may predict for a shorter response duration to ruxolitinib. But other than that, it's probably somebody that was appropriately started on ruxolitinib, and now, after a couple of years, we are seeing some escape and we are seeing progression here.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I mean, certainly this panel of higher risk mutations, particularly the ASXL1, you know, would give me a concern about long-term prognosis. And I do think the stem cell transplanter needs to be part of the team in this discussion, as well as, where will transplant potentially fit in along the way, particularly given that age of 62. All of that said, those mutations might suggest, for me, perhaps in the future, we know that the BET inhibitor, which I had mentioned from Constellation Pharmaceuticals, is having as some data in combination with JAK inhibition as frontline, and that BET inhibition may play a role in individuals with ASXL1 mutation. So this might be an individual that a combination BET inhibitor, JAK inhibitor may play a role. I know there's other BET inhibitor combination studies, I believe one from Incyte, that's going to be coming up in the future as well. That might be an interesting option for such a patient.
So thank you both for that excellent discussion. I think there's a number of themes, right? And investigational therapy is absolutely something that needs to be considered. And fortunately, there are some drugs, as Dr. Mace is pointing out, that look promising at this point. Clearly, also, allogeneic stem cell transplant needs to be a consideration given the patient's age. Part of the question, of course, becomes, what's the timing of that? And do we start another therapy first and try to get the disease under better control before going to transplant? Do we consider going to transplant in the near term? Not questions with easy answers. Let's talk about a little bit of the data that my colleagues have already alluded to. We know that, although ruxolitinib has made a major difference in the lives of patients with myelofibrosis, there are limits to the durability of its effect, and there are at least reasonably good understandings of some of the biochemical reasons for that, but a large proportion of patients lose their response over time. Now, as we talked about earlier, the mutational profile does appear to play a role in predicting who may fail therapy. And there are really two major takeaways. One is that mutations in ASXL1, as is the case here, EZH2 or DNMT3A, appear to all be associated with a risk of earlier time to treatment failure. As well, the number of mutations appears to play a role. So having three or more mutations is also associated with a much earlier time to treatment failure, as is the case with this patient. The biology behind these observations remains to be determined. We also know that when patients do fail ruxolitinib, their outcomes are poor. So in patients who discontinue ruxolitinib, the median survival is about 14 months. And this is made worse if patients have low platelets at the start of their therapy, or if they develop a new mutation such as ASXL1 during the course of their therapy, or have any other evidence of clonal evolution. So what are our options? We've talked about some of them from the investigational standpoint, but of course we have the data from the JAKARTA2 trial utilizing fedratinib. Now the initial study allowed patients on who had ruxolitinib exposure only for a short amount of time, but I think more pertinent to this discussion was the reanalysis that was presented at ASCO 2019, whereby the analysis was focused on patients who had been on ruxolitinib for 6 months or more. In this population of patients who had significant ruxolitinib exposure, spleen volume response was 30%, symptom response was 27%. And so in at least a portion of patients, it seems that one can salvage a response by switching to fedratinib therapy after having had ruxolitinib exposure. What about ruxolitinib rechallenge? So one idea that has been tried, I think more so prior to the approval of fedratinib, was to withdraw ruxolitinib and then reintroduce it. And in fact, there's a reasonable biochemical explanation for this in that what we know is that with exposure to ruxolitinib, JAK-STAT persistence occurs, meaning that initially the JAK-STAT pathway is attenuated, but over time, heterodimers form, which can actually get around the JAK inhibition and cause reactivation of the JAK-STAT signaling pathway. So it is a reasonable thing to think about withdrawing the drug and then reintroducing it to try to salvage an effect. And in fact, this work from the Cleveland Clinic group shows that in patients who have an initial treatment response, a second treatment rechallenge in a proportion of these patients can actually result in spleen size reduction. So that is not an unreasonable option to think about as well. And of course, as my colleagues talked about, there are a number of investigational options, which is a wonderful thing for our patients. We've talked about the BET inhibitor, the LSD1 inhibitor. There are TGF-beta signaling inhibitors. One principle here to note is that these trials encompass not only combination with JAK inhibitors, but also single agent therapy. So much yet to be learned about these agents.
Rajit, let me ask you a question right there, just taking a cue from what you just said, actually a question to both of you. What is your view on keeping the ruxolitinib and adding an agent, as in the add-on trials for our patient here, versus switching to a different mechanism of action altogether, or fedratinib, now that we have so many different choices?
I was going to say, I think it's an excellent question. You know, I think as we have more approved agents, the add-on, I think, will be more patient-friendly than, you know, I think in real-world settings, we're not going to abruptly stop the ruxolitinib, have a washout, and then start another drug. You know, that's a very artificial construct, you know, in the setting of clinical trials. I think data, let's say, with the navitoclax study where navitoclax was added to ruxolitinib, you know, it's a nice model of trying to help patients further. I do think, you know, fedratinib is a good second line option for folks because they can use it at the current time. You know, I think as we have additional options, again, we'll weigh those pluses and minuses. I think whether there is value to switching from one JAK inhibitor to another may depend a little bit on the character of what is going on with the patient. You know, a patient that clearly had 4 years of wonderful response to ruxolitinib and has now clearly progressed, you know, may need a different mechanism of action. The individual that has been on a JAK inhibitor and it's just suboptimal might benefit from the add-on approach. So I do think the clinical situation will be important.
Right. Thank you, Ruben. Rajit, did you have any thoughts on that?
I would agree with Ruben completely, right? I think that the add-on strategy is in many cases, a much more feasible strategy for patients, right? I think one of the things we do need to think about, which we don't really know that much about, is what are the pathways involved in resistance? We know that JAK-STAT signaling activates a number of different pathways, and it's worth asking the question, are they different in different groups of patients, and can those pathways be targeted by certain drugs? So we may be in a position eventually to select agents that are based on the biology of a patient's relapse, but these are things that are under study at the moment.
Right, personalized therapy for MF. Yes, something we would definitely all like to be there at some point. With that, we'll get into the third case here presented by Dr. Mesa. And this is also a myelofibrosis case.
I wanted to pivot and take a little sort of different situation regarding that choice around frontline therapy. So here's a 70-year-old, splenomegaly and symptoms. Again, difficult disease right out of the chute. He's lost weight, night sweats, fatigue, big spleen, some elevation in the blasts, and a high-risk molecular profile with both the ASXL1 and EZH2 mutation. The platelets are 70,000. So normal starting for ruxolitinib would suggest a lower dose of ruxolitinib to start with. Now, how do we think about risk in an individual like this? Well, by our old DIPSS scoring system, this individual would be high risk. And by the new MIPSS is also high risk. But I think even with a bit of greater concern as we weave in these high risk molecular features. Now, I also like to consider the issue of disease burden in that risk is an assessment of survival. And the choice of our medical therapy is guided both by impact on survival, but also on burden. So symptoms, splenomegaly, and anemia. The patient, certainly the issue of transplant is a reasonable discussion. At age 70, it's a very, very complex decision, and this patient declines. And indeed, that's not atypical. I would say that I clearly have had patients who on paper are clearly transplant candidates, but in practice have decided not to undertake that approach. So based on risk and baseline thrombocytopenia, this is someone that I began on fedratinib. Fedratinib, as I'll show in a moment, can be dosed at full dose, frontline, for individuals with a platelet count of 50 to 100,000. So let me open that up to my colleagues. Fedratinib is now approved in both settings, and this is one of the areas that there may be some clear differentiation in that fedratinib can be dosed at full dose at 400 milligrams per day, and ruxolitinib can be used, but frequently would be started at 5 twice a day in such a group. Thoughts?
Yes, Ruben, actually very intriguing discussion here, because I'm yet to actually use fedratinib as a frontline treatment, but absolutely agree that this is one setting where the data are very interesting. As I'm sure you're going to show us, fedratinib does not require a dose reduction and has comparable efficacy in this platelet range as in the higher platelets, whereas with Rux you would have to reduce the dose, which makes you worry that you'll get less of a spleen response, because we know that the spleen response to Rux is dose dependent. So definitely an area where fedratinib is a very very interesting, very reasonable consideration.
I think absolutely the platelet count would mitigate the dose of ruxolitinib, so that makes complete sense, and I think this is a good use of fedratinib at this point. We certainly don't know whether the same implications that we know of with ASXL1 pertain to fedratinib as they do for ruxolitinib. Is it reasonable to suppose that they do? Yeah, but we don't have evidence at this point. I think the other thing to point out, of course, is that given this patient's profile, as Ruben has pointed out, was very high risk at the beginning. And I think this is also a patient that one may consider for an upfront clinical trial if one is available. But absolutely, and I think in the real-world setting, fedratinib makes a lot of sense for many reasons.
Yeah, cases like this, as we talk about, the new frontline studies, like let's say, BET inhibition up front with JAK inhibition, is it overkill in some cases, even if it were efficacious? I think higher risk situations like this might be, again, a place as we individualize therapy where more intensive therapy up front might be worthwhile. But let me take you through a bit of some of this data, and that I think it's important that we've continued to learn additional information from analysis of the Jakarta and the Jakarta 2 study. So this was presented at last year's ASH with myself, Claire Harrison, and many colleagues looking at these data. And we looked at the individuals on the Jakarta study, which had been the frontline study, of fedratinib versus placebo, with a baseline platelet count of 50 to 100,000 versus above 100,000. And with that, we saw spleen volume response rates and symptom response rates that were vastly superior to placebo. The study was not structured with this as a pre-established stratification factor. So it was not powered to compare between 50 to 100 versus above 100, but seemed to be very similar in terms of the depth of response. We look here at the individual improvements in the splenomegaly, and again, seeing very significant activity, and of course, not surprising, vastly superior to placebo. You know, it should be noted that, again, the Jakarta study was very much the parallel study to the COMFORT study, that these drugs were being tested in a similar period of time, fedratinib just slightly after that of ruxolitinib, and compared to placebo, because at that point in time, this preceded the approval of any other agent. Now, Jakarta 2, this was the second line study, and again, stratification between 50 to 100 versus above 100,000. In terms of baseline characteristics, again, we see a relatively similar distribution in terms of splenomegaly and burden of disease in individuals, regardless of the baseline platelet count. Here again, we saw spleen volume response rates and symptom response rates that were very similar in the group with thrombocytopenia, as well as the group with a baseline platelet count of above 100,000. In this instance, the numbers are numerically higher, but again, I would say that the analysis is not one to directly allow comparison between those two groups. Here again, this was a single arm study, so there's no placebo comparison arm, but one sees the significant benefit in terms of improvement in splenomegaly, even in these individuals with thrombocytopenia. Again, they were able to get full dose and get the full benefit of the medical therapy. So how does this fit in with our treatment guidelines? Again, emphasizing that according to our NCCN guidelines, that fedratinib is a parallel frontline option to ruxolitinib for individuals with a platelet count above 50,000. And I think that group between 50 to 100,000 is a group where we know of some differentiation between the two therapies.
So let me ask you, Ruben, a question, both of you, of course, Ruben and Rajit, what your views are on this. So sometimes something I struggle with is, of course, the survival benefit that we know that ruxolitinib has now with 5 years of follow-up of the COMFORT trials. And also remembering that that survival benefit was in that population, which is the platelets 100 and higher. Do you ever wrestle with that aspect, as well as the fedratinib data that Ruben nicely went through just now for us, when you pick a frontline option?
I think the point you raise is a good one. You know, I think it's important to note that with fedratinib, its approval process, and we've not gotten into that in great depth with this evening's discussion, is that it had a period where it was on an FDA clinical hold because of the concerns regarding Wernicke's encephalopathy that subsequently was resolved and the drug now approved with a mandate to monitor for thiamine and to watch for a rare possibility of Wernicke's encephalopathy. But because of that, the patients did not have long-term data on fedratinib because they were taken off the study. I suspect if they had remained on the study, responding patients would have had a survival benefit. I honestly believe, having been involved with treating so many patients on JAK inhibitors over the years with momelotinib, pacvenidenib, fedratinib, and ruxolitinib, I think patients on JAK inhibition who respond have likely a survival benefit with each of the agents. Proving it is a much more complicated matter, but I believe that it likely is a class effect.
Right. Rajit, any concluding thoughts on that?
I think that, yeah, I would absolutely agree, right? I mean, you know, the only concern maybe is there a late toxicity, and clearly we have seen with the JAK inhibitors that there certainly can be differential toxicity profiles. Is that enough to overcome the benefit of JAK inhibitors, you know, in the intermediate term in a five-year span in patients? I don't think that we know, but I also don't think that it's very likely.
Right.
Yeah. I think with fedratinib, I think what we will find is as treating physicians become more comfortable with it in the second line setting, I think it will continue to evolve to have a at least a solid place as a consideration in frontline as individuals are much more comfortable with its use.
Great points. Well, thank you both for what I hope was for our viewers and an interesting and educational discussion. Thank you for listening. Thank you, everybody, for joining us this evening. Thank you.